I really want to have some fun with you on this topic, this problem of God, for those of us who study communication. Now, here's an example of what I mean about the problem of God in communication. Several days ago, our son came back to our home in Grand Rapids. He was very tired because I got him one of these tickets on Flyer Miles, and he had to get up extremely early in the morning in Boston, 4:30, he said. Afternoon, I picked him up at the airport, and he says, I need to take a nap. I said, great, take a nap. I've got some work to do anyway. So I'm on the computer working. He's taking a nap. I said, I'll wake you up in 2 hours. He said, great. At the end of the first hour, I start hearing a sound, and it's kind of a high-pitched, sounds like somebody using one of these leaf blowers outside. But I go outside, and it's not there. So it's inside. So then I come inside. Where is this thing? I would go in room after room after room in the house, and I couldn't find it. And finally I thought, well, maybe it's between the floors. Maybe we got wiring that's arcing or something's going on in the house. Maybe it's an exhaust fan. I'm spending a bunch of time now, about 45 minutes looking for this thing. No luck. I figure I need some help on this. It's time to wake up our son. I wake him up, say, I got a problem. Do you hear that sound? He says, no. Now listen carefully. Do you hear that sound? It's high-pitched. He says, yes, I do hear it. I said, okay, that thing's been bothering me for an hour. I can't get any work done, and I don't know what it is. Can you help me find it? He says, sure. So the two of us start on the first floor of our house. We're going through all the different rooms. And we would go into a room, and I kid you not, we would be standing in a corner, and it would be louder. We would turn around to the center of the room, and it would start to disappear. And I'd say, it's in this corner. He said, no, I think it's in the ceiling. I said, no, I don't think so. And so go to the next room. Sometimes it would seem to disappear, reappear. We go to the lower level of the house. But finally, I think I found it. My wife's computer, which was on, even though she was not home, under a desk. And I see the light, and I put my head down there under the desk, and I can hear it quite loudly. Aha, it's coming from the computer. So I back away from there. I said, Steve, take a listen. What do you think? He gets under there. Oh, not there. I said, come on now. It is there. He said, no, it's not. And I went down there again. Listen, maybe you're right. Maybe it's not here. So we go back upstairs again. We go to my computer. I do the same thing. I go under the desk where my computer is, and I listen. Sure enough, now I got it. I said, Steve, take a listen to this. And I'm standing right there by the desk, and he gets down on all fours, and he goes under there and listens a little bit by the computer. He says, no, it's not down here. I'm thinking, what do you mean it's not down there? Where is this? And as he backs away from being under there, and his head goes by my pocket, he says, Dad, I think it's in your pocket. And I reached in my pocket, and I pulled out my cell phone that was squealing. 2 hours of time. And now we think about it. We would go into a room, you see, and it's in my pocket. We get in the corner, and of course it's bouncing off the wall, and we're convinced it's in that corner. Then when I would turn around, it wouldn't be there anymore. I would go under the desk thinking it was there, it's in my pocket, it's here. He would get under, it's not there. And round we would go on this until, by chance, he found it. That is the life of a scholar right there. Now, where is God in that? What am I listening for? Do I know what I'm listening for? What is the end of the listening? Am I solving problems? Sometimes I work on things, and I get to the conclusion of something, and I say, this is it. And I think all I was doing is listening to myself. I haven't gotten any wisdom outside of myself. I'm just talking to myself. What is this crazy business? And in fact, I would suggest to you that that opening story is really symptomatic, if I can use it as a metaphor, of what you and I are in the midst of thinking about the relationship between faith and communication. Because in some sense, if we believe in a God thesis, however we define that, and we assume that somehow God is active in the world in some way communicating, we are faced with the dilemma of distinguishing between what is communication, where we as human beings are simply talking to ourselves, running around the house and finally finding the cell phone in our pockets, or to what extent we are actually discovering God speaking anywhere, through anything, through anyone. I got to thinking about this recently, reading Soren Kierkegaard, A book I would recommend to you is called Provocations. There is a wonderful quote from Kierkegaard where he says, "What we really fear is being alone, not being wrong." Now, the context there is that because we're social creatures, we have this tendency to go along with what other people believe and to follow them, rather than going in the direction which may make us look weird or odd, but in fact is the right direction to go. We're more scared of being thought of being crazy or odd or somehow completely off track than we are of being wrong, as long as we're wrong with other people. And I got to thinking about this in terms of the study of communication and wondering, what would it look like if we posited something about the existence of God in the world as a communicator for the work that we do? How weird would we seem? I think it would be fundamentally different from what you and I think now about most of our research. Recently, I went through public speaking introductory textbooks because I've gone back to teaching basic public speaking. It really occurred to me again how secular they are, not just in the sense that they don't talk about God, but they try to put everything into a simplistic little box, almost a closed system, and to assume that you can understand everything about human communication within this system. And then they say, here are the techniques that you need to master. That may be a reasonable way of approaching teaching public speaking, but I got to think, what about God in this system? Or if we're not willing to talk about God in the system, what about mystery? What about serendipity? What about fun? I mean, you want to read dull books? Look at these public speaking books. They're not enough to inspire anybody to speak some interesting fashion about anything. What about humor? I got to thinking, why isn't there any humor here? Part of my background is Jewish, and I have a strong sense of the importance of the Jewish people in the history of the world and in relationship to God. Appreciate what God has done through the Jewish people, and I've come to the conclusion that Jewish people are comics and they're funny and they're good storytellers in part because they really have gotten a sense of the dissonance between the way God would want the world to be and the way it is. Protestants are running around trying to save the world and trying to eliminate all of this mystery. And Catholics are running around finding mystery everywhere, so you wonder if there is any mystery left anymore. And the Jews are running around saying, this is crazy. I just spent 2 hours running around my house looking for this sound and it was in my pocket. The cell phone button was stuck. Now, what would happen with public speaking if we were teaching public speaking and we took this into account, that there is reality beyond this little closed system with its techniques? There's mystery, there's fun, there's grace, there's humor. What would happen? Or on the other side, what happens when we don't? Here's a quote from Waiting for God. We examine human society and souls closely and with real attention. We see that wherever the virtue of supernatural light is absent, everything is obedient to mechanical laws, as blind and as exact as the laws of gravity. That, I think, is what's happened to a lot of the study of communication that has not faced the problem of God. We so reduce what communication is, and we suck out of it the mystery and much of the joy and the craziness and the humor. Let's assume there is a God, and any time we think that we've got everything figured out, we're fooling ourselves, like running around with the cell phone and the button on in our pockets. And instead, let's have what some folks would say in the social sciences is one more box. You know, we've got the whole system worked out, the inputs and the outputs and everything else, and let's add one more and call it whatever you want to call it. That's the God box. And there's no way that we can legitimately, I think, completely eliminate that box. There was a time when many scholars assumed that they could, and the academy tended to get quite secular, but now we know that the secularization theses that were out there in psychology and sociology and anthropology and all have simply not come true. That this religious impulse that people have, if I can call it a quest to know God and thereby know themselves better, is simply part of the human condition. And so anthropologically speaking, no matter where you go, you find people who are either worshiping in some manifestation God or something like God or a substitute for God. And so they have their little God box, and they call it whatever they want. And Karl Marx had his thing to put in there to explain everything else away, and the structuralists have theirs, and so on. And so we build these models of communication and society and power and everything else where we put something in there that is either the admission that there is this mystery in the existence of God, or we substitute for God something else which invariably does not offer all of the explanatory power that we had hoped. And so sometimes you just have to laugh about it. I'm convinced that many of the people that you and I have read from graduate school on that have most influenced us and that we have appreciated the most are those who operate with the assumption of a God box. They assume that God is there. This is part of their thesis. What about Kenneth Burke? I don't think you can read him any other way. To a large extent, what Burke is trying to do is to create a semi-secular view of rhetoric, but to include in it something along the lines that we are godlike, or at least we're metaphors or analogies to God. And in some of his early work on the rhetoric of religion and so forth, this was incredibly clear. He is a sort of closet theologian. And I suspect to you that's why you have the Kenneth Burke Society. It's like a tribe, a denomination, the Burke followers. I have found in my own life over the years this to be the case with Walter Ong. I find with Ong again and again that I'm confronted with the mystery of things beyond what's just on the surface with communication. The same thing with Jim Carrey, who's one of my advisors at the University of Illinois and who is practicing Catholic and has never quite been able to conceive of communication apart from, I think, what is for him essentially a Catholic perspective, a sort of sacramental and ritual-based view of communication. I think one of the best books in the last 15 years or so on communication is John Durham Peters' book, Speaking Into the Air. And here you have somebody who is writing a University of Chicago Press book about communication theory, which is really, in some respects, an anti-dialogue book. It's to say, if you think that you can only understand communication as dialogue, you're fooling yourself. There's much more to communication than that, and it's much more mysterious than that. And you're not going to be able to reduce it to just dialogue, especially just dialogue between human beings. There are things that come into the system from outside, and who knows where they come. There's serendipity, there's confusion, there's chaos, there's also cosmos that comes out of it. And so he writes a whole book about this crazy idea of speaking into the air. We could subtitle it something like prayer. Now for me, dealing with this issue of God in our communication comes down ultimately to the question of listening, not the question of speaking. I admit that we're speakers as human beings, that oral communication is incredibly important, and there are other forms as well. But I've come to the conclusion more and more that the problematic that we have to address, that we have not addressed well enough, really has to do with what is listening. And I came to this conclusion from some of my own interests in the Hebrew tradition of studying the Old Testament and commentaries on the Old Testament and getting a grasp on what listening meant in an oral culture like we have, at least in the earlier sections of the Old Testament. And here, listening, we can say, is defined more or less as attending to things, or to be almost literal with it, listening means to be obedient, to be obedient. That's part of the problem for me. What do I do with that? Here I have a vision of what listening is from the scriptures, which seems to me to be fundamentally different from the vast majority of ways that listening is talked about in the field that I am part of. Well, as I studied the Old Testament, studied the New Testament and the carrying through of listening, slow to speak, quick to listen, and so forth, which, by the way, is something I want to hang at all of our faculty senate meetings, be slow to speak and quick to listen. I thought to myself, you know what, maybe what we ought to do here is to just assume the same way that the Hebrew and Christian traditions do, that God has already spoken. The reason we start with listening and not speaking to ourselves is because God has already spoken. Now that's a thesis, okay? It's a matter for me of faith that I affirm, but it's a thesis. So here's a story about this. My wife and I are in sabbatical a few years ago living in Florida, and we have a condo on an inland lake. It's not an ostentatious thing. It's in this little condo complex with people probably average 80, 85 years of age, and they call us the kids. And there's this little pond behind the condo. We're up fairly early in the morning, and we're sitting out there for fresh squeezed orange juice, praying some and eating breakfast and looking out over this little, and we start to notice some birds showing up. And we start tracking some of these birds and paying attention. And after a while, we can identify specific birds, individual birds, not species, but an individual bird. That's so-and-so, and that's so-and-so. And they come back about this time, and he's doing this today, and he must not be feeling well, and so forth. Okay, you start anthropomorphizing these birds. And so we're thinking about these birds, and we're buying bird books, and we're sort of getting into birding. And what are we getting into birding for? What is this all about? And it begins to dawn on us one day that simply paying attention to what's going on behind our condo is changing our view of reality. The birds are not talking to us in the sense of using English. They're talking to themselves or signaling in some way. But as we pay attention, that is, as we listen to them, we are coming to get a greater sense of the incredible creational landscape and its inhabitants behind our condo. And we start to get a sense that God is behind this. And God is a miraculous God to create all of this. And so here we are, in a sense, paying attention to the creation. And what we are hearing is that there is a marvelous God behind it. And this sabbatical for us, in part because of that paying attention to behind the condo, was a very wonderful time for us, for our relationship with each other, with God, and with the creation. How do I account for that as a communication scholar? Why did I start listening to the creation? Why did I see in it what I did? Do the heavens declare, the hills clap their hands? What do I do with this? It seemed to come into this otherwise closed system as I began to listen a little bit. And this is what I would suggest to you. It means, in part, to be a scholar who's interested in the relationship between faith and communication. It means being open to this problem that if God exists and God somehow speaks, this might make a difference in what we see, what we hear. It will change our attention and it may change some of our conclusions. Now, what I've not said about this is anything specific about what we will hear in a specific context, because I don't know. For me, that's part of the joy of being a scholar in this field with these relationships between faith and communication. You don't know exactly what you're going to find out. We admit that up front. And if we accept the existence of God as a speaker in some form in the system, then we're likely to be surprised. And we're not likely to fall into the kind of mechanical view of communication. Where do we go with this, if what I say has any value at all? Well, I don't know that you should listen to me, because I'm the one that took 40 minutes of my son's time to go hunting for a magic sound from the solar system. After that, the two of us laughed so hard, so long about it. We still laugh about it. And I got to thinking about these people that are listening for signals from other life forms, you know. And I would always say to myself, I could never fall prey to that. I'm not going to listen to Art Bell at 2 a.m., you know. But then I got to thinking, what did I just do, you know? I'm listening to something squealing in my pocket and thinking the world's going to tubes or something. But here are some ideas, some things for you to think about. The God thesis will lead us invariably to seek ethnographic understanding. I'm not saying ethnography is the only methodology. I'm saying ethnographic understanding. And by that I mean to take our understanding of communication phenomena in part from the experience of those who are having the experiences. I happen to believe this theologically, that this is in a sense the way God operates. It's through people, and if we start listening around, we're going to find out that God was there before us. But even apart from that, it makes an awful lot of sense, because the alternative, in a kind of deductive sense, is to create all kinds of religious or theological or biblical categories and then try and impose those on the experience of faith among those who communicate. And while there's some value in the latter thing, and I think some of us ought to do that, I'm not so sure that's the best kind of listening for where we are in the world right now. And the reason I say that, again, goes back to what I suggested earlier. Many of the things that have most influenced us in our own growing up, in our schooling, in our study, in graduate school, and everything else, have been these things that come in because God was there already. We could look at ourselves ethnographically and say, how would somebody study us as scholars of communication? And what would happen if they simply put us into categories? you're in this category, and this is your theory, and you're in that category, and you're that category, and how different that would be from the variety of ways and the rich fabric involved in the way you and I experience this communication of God's. So I think ethnographic understanding is really important. And one of the things I tried to do in this new book on Christianity and the media in America is to go to a bunch of journals. I went to some Catholic journals and Protestant journals, evangelical as well as mainline, and I listened to what they said for about 35 years about broadcasting in America. What I found there was some incredibly wise stuff that these people had said. In fact, I think just as wise about the problems and the opportunities in American broadcasting as you would find from secular publications or from the FCC at the time. The conversations were there. And now ethnographically for that, I had to go to the documents and find out what people were saying because the conversations are not taking place right now. A second thing is to attend to our assumptions, because our assumptions, of course, enable us and they get us into trouble. Academic assumptions are like denominations. You can't live with them and you can't live without them. And so we need assumptions to move on, but the assumptions can cloud so that we're not able to listen very clearly to what's actually going on. I don't think we can get rid of assumptions, but I do think we can attend to our own assumptions. In a sense, we can listen to ourselves and the communities we're part of and get to know our assumptions a little bit better so that we are not so blind to them. I believe that the current assumption, the reigning assumption in communication studies, is naturalism. It pervades the study of communication, and it is causing us enormous problems as a discipline in all the sub-areas. By naturalism, I simply mean a view of the world that says there is matter and nothing else matters. Everything can be explained in terms of matter, and there is, therefore, a closed system of matter. And we as human beings are merely material creatures as well. To even posit the suggestion of a spiritual life or a spiritual aspect of human beings that cannot be explained away in terms of naturalism is problematic by and large in the field. Now, we will admit in our field that there's confusion and there's conflict, but to admit that there are things that are beyond our understanding because the naturalistic view of reality is insufficient is not something that most people are going to admit in the field of communication today. And I believe it leads to things like public speaking textbooks that are deadly dull. It turns us as human beings into machines, senders and receivers and transmitters, because all of those kinds of metaphors ultimately are taken, if not from biology itself, from electronics and from signaling and from cybernetics, and there's a whole history to this. Why should we think that we're exactly like machines? And we talk about smart computers. What is a smart computer? Am I a smart human being because I spend an hour and 40 minutes looking for a signal that's in my pocket? What's going on here? To compare ourselves with machines and to talk about human communication simply in terms of senders and receivers as if we're in a closed system and there's nothing outside that system, it seems to me to be very, very problematic. And so one of my projects now is looking at this issue because it worries me. I wonder, on the one hand, can any of us say anything for certain? This is what God says. I mean, that carries a kind of arrogance too. On the other hand, it seems to me that we're confused about what we say with each other. Why shouldn't we be confused about what God says? I've looked back at this whole idea of probability in communication, because so many of our studies, and not just in the social science side, but so many of our studies in communication are based on the probability of a particular outcome. Where does that idea come from as applied to human beings rather than to the physical world itself? I would commend to you an incredible book by Eon Hocking, H-O-C-K-I-N-G, called The Emergence of Probability. The Emergence of Probability. It's a history of the concept of probability, which to a large extent is the history of the concept of naturalism or a closed system in our understanding of what it means to be human and to be a society and also with communication. And what he finds is a historical shift to something like what is probable statistically from something that we have virtually lost, except in a few subspecialties like communication ethics. You see, what comes before the idea of probability, at least in Western culture, is the idea of attending ourselves to what is worthy of approbation. It's not that a norm makes something right. It's attention to wisdom, to probity. It is, in a sense, looking for what is right and good and proper and following that, not to adjust ourselves in such a way that we somehow maximize a particular outcome. And worst of all, that we would view ourselves merely in terms of some kind of mean, some kind of average. And so what this movement, this emergence of probability, I think, has really done is to put us into more and more of a closed system in our own thinking about what happens with human communication. And it has also led to all kinds of utopian schemes, whether they're Marxist schemes or structuralist schemes or anything. Take almost any ism and plug it in there, and you'll find some people in that ism who have created a closed system and believe if they can just tinker with elements within that closed system, they can more or less create heaven on earth. And I don't believe that's the case. I don't believe history suggests that that is possible whatsoever. There's too much trouble in the system. There's too much slop. There's too much uncertainty. So naturalism, I think, is one assumption that we have to attend to. Now, we might say if we attend to it by looking at our assumptions about God, that God is a holy other, and God is out there, and God does not speak, God is not personal, or even if God is personal, God is unapproachable. Too distant to be involved in the system on this earth. And I can appreciate people who take that point of view, in particular because of the evil and injustice in the world. Sometimes all of us wonder, is God involved in this thing? God, speak, tell him off, make things right. And it doesn't seem to happen. So maybe God is a holy other out there. Within naturalism, of course, the tendency was to move toward deism. With the holy other, the tendency is to say, don't know. Don't know. And a third option, of course, is theism. And I suspect that most of us in this room would one way or another identify with theism, that there is a personal God, that God is a speaker, that God might even be the speech agent of history who makes things happen through speech. And I'm using speech in a generic sense, not just talking, but using communication in some way to shape and form history and people and renew lives. Now, this is my view. The problem with this view is that I also know for myself holding this view that we are never going to be able to be like God in knowing for certain when God is talking and when we are. And any time that we move into a kind of theism that suggests that we are like God, we become part of the problem. So we live in doubt. We see through the darkness, some things and some things better than others, by grace I would say, but we don't see things perfectly. So positing theism as a different kind of assumption does not solve the God problem for us. In fact, it creates a worse problem because it commits us to a box in the system that might in fact shape every other box in the system. And what do we do then? Adam and Eve, in some respects, were the first postmoderns. They were the ones who, as the scripture tells us, got a notion that they could define reality apart from God and thereby set in motion a real problem, a disunity between the symbols that human beings use to define and operate within reality and the way reality is. And their brokenness, I believe in the Hebrew and Christian traditions, becomes our brokenness. And so here we are, even as theists, admitting that we've got this problem. The Protestant impulse here is to solve the problem, to come up with the explanations, to rationalize it. Protestantism, more or less historically in the West, has taken on some of the elements of the Enlightenment. And this has led us into other problems because if I think I can solve this and I'm the scholar who can tell you exactly where God is speaking in this particular study, and somebody else comes along and says, oh no, I got it differently. Pretty soon you got two denominations, or three, or four, or five, or ten. And it doesn't solve the problem for us. So invariably we end up within theism of having to work together. And this, of course, is exactly what Augustine tried to do with respect to the history of the church and how do you interpret scripture. He said, ultimately, it's got to be a community issue. And anytime you just have individuals running around saying, this is how I interpret it, or this is what God is telling me, you're going to get into trouble. Augustine's system doesn't solve the problem, but it says, I think for us today as scholars in this, we can help hold each other accountable and be careful for claiming too much because we are not the God in the box, even if we are theists. Third, we need to engage the voices of tradition. I won't say a lot about this other than to say that I think we have not done a very good job, many of us in communication, me included, in going back to some of the major things that people have said in the past throughout history about the relationship between faith and communication. There is incredible stuff out there that we have more or less forgotten that even exists, and we need to dip back into that. To rediscover, in a sense, those horizons of this relationship between faith and communication that are already out there. G.K. Chesterton said that tradition is the democracy of the dead. We ought not to dump the past, because if we dump the past, we are going to be cutting ourselves off from much of the wisdom that's already there about the God problem.